And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website, podcastufo.com, for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. First of all, I want to quickly thank James R. and Bobby H. for your recent donations, and of course, many monthly subscribers. That really helps keep us going. I really do appreciate that. We have some breaking news on a new newscaster. Did I say that right? We're excited to announce a polished podcaster, John Tobin. I was on his show last week. I really enjoyed talking to him, and we kind of click. I've known him for a while now. And I'm real excited to have him on the show. He's going to be our new newscaster. He'll be here each week heading up UFO News, our UFO News department, which in reality, we are just stealing things from our news person, Peggy Shunning, who posts as our admin on our very active Facebook page. I did air quotes on that. I think we have almost like 7,700 people on that page now. And a lot of it has to do with Peggy. She's very active and keeps it interesting. Oh, and by the way, all the news stories that we have in our show notes are all linked to their sources. So if you go to our show notes on our page, you will see that. Well, tonight we have an interview coming up with former FBI agent, host, and lead investigator of Sci-Fi Channel's Fact or Faked Paranormal Files. Love that show. Watched many, many episodes. Mr. Ben Hansen. Ben will be talking to us about the International UFO Congress he just attended and a lot more. Well, Ben always has a lot of very interesting things to say. This will be his second time on the show. And in my opinion, he's a very well-balanced and, you know, a really cool guy. He's down to earth and the kind of person you really want investigating UFOs. He'll be coming up right after the music break. For now, John Tobin with the news. Welcome, John.
Hey, Martin. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to being a part of the show, and I'm excited to present the news.
Yes, I am too. You know, we stopped doing the news when Michael Lauk couldn't be on the show anymore because of, you know, the show being at nighttime. That's when his work schedule is. Sure. And, you know, since we stopped doing the news, I bet I've had at least 100 emails from listeners out there saying, please bring back the news. We miss it. And even though we're stealing it from Peggy, it's still probably news to someone out there. So let's roll right into it right now. Go ahead.
It is. Today playing the role of Peggy will be me, John Tobin, your new news guy here on Podcast UFO. First story we've got for you tonight, Martin, is pretty interesting. Arizona witness photographs red glowing disc UFO at treetops. Two-year Arizona witnesses in Maricopa reported watching a red glowing light around the treetop level with a disc-like outline, according to February 11, 2014 testimony and case number 54021 from the MUFON UFO Network, or Mutual UFO Network, also known as MUFON, of course, witness reporting database. The witness described the object. It had a red glow to it. It's caught in the remaining 20 seconds before it left our field of view. But the witness's mother had been watching the object for about 2 whole minutes. Of course, links, as Martin had mentioned earlier, to this full story are available on our show notes at podcastufo.com. What do you think of this, Martin? I was looking at that picture on the report, and pretty interesting.
Yeah, you know, well, you know, I was getting a little bored with the typical UFO colors, and this one is a really cool color. It's sort of like a pink Art Deco neon, you know, kind of like down in South Beach, Miami. So. Yeah. You know, I'm kind of digging the color of it. No, I never saw one that color, and some really good pictures of it, actually.
there are some very good pictures. And being a ghost guy myself, looking at this, it looks like a really bad ghost picture until you realize it's taken in the treetops outside looking upward. And as a UFO photograph, it's pretty intriguing. It's a very unusual glow. I think a lot of folks would think of a light or white-colored glow from some of these things that are seen. But this red-pink color is very interesting. I thought that was... quite compelling. I think folks should definitely check that out. Interesting story. I wonder if anything will come of that, you know?
Yeah, you know, I almost forgot to announce our chat room. Our chat room. I haven't been on that to see if anybody's... yeah, there's people on it, by golly. So did you happen to catch the quote she says later on? Let's see. And I quote here, when it was at midway point of the viewing area, she could see a disc-like outline in about 6 protrusion-type areas. She described them as wart-like, and that was her best description she could come up with, unquote. I've never heard a UFO described as wart-like.
Wart-like.
Not real, yeah.
Not appealing, but I think it looks way more appealing than a wart, to be honest. It really does.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's way more interesting to look at than your average wart, I should say.
Yeah.
Got some other great stories here, Martin. I want to tell you about this one thing that I know has been going around for a while. I've heard about this too, but Mars rover heads uphill after solving the donut riddle. There was a jelly donut rock, for those of you who haven't heard of it before. It's been floating around, no pun intended, that appeared out of nowhere, and that is now solved. So thank goodness for that. Researchers have determined the now infamous Martian rock resembling a jelly donut, dubbed Pinnacle Island, is a piece of larger rock broken and moved by the wheel of NASA's Mars Exploration Rover Opportunity in early January. Only about 1.5 inches wide, just about 4 centimeters, the white-rimmed, red-centered rock caused a stir last month when it appeared in an image the rover took January 8th at a location where it was not present 4 days earlier. More recent images show the original piece of rock struck by the rover's wheel slightly uphill from where Pinnacle Island came to rest. Once we moved Opportunity a short distance after inspecting Pinnacle Island, we could see directly uphill an overturned rock that is the same unusual appearance, said Opportunity Deputy Principal Investigator Ray Arvidson of Washington University in St. Louis. We drove over it. We could see the track. That's where Pinnacle Island came from. Very interesting.
Yeah, well, yeah. I would call it the first Martian roadkill. What do you think of that?
Martian roadkill. I like that.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if this solves any of the mystery or... you know, any of the rumors around that donuts purchased after noon are actually Martian rocks, and that way there's a connection between the jelly donuts and the actual rocks from Mars.
I was going to say out of this world, or this could have been dropped by a Martian patrol officer.
That's true.
I guess that conspiracy is off the table now.
It's off the table. Visions of Jetson cars in my head on that one.
Yeah. So what else is going on?
Well, we got some other stuff going on. Did you know that the world's first UFO landing pad and first landing was actually in a country very close to ours? It's up to our neighbors to the north, up in Canada, who are now our hockey rivals, if you guys have been watching the Olympics, in a town called St. Paul, Alberta. It's a small town in east-central Alberta, Canada. They had the world's first official UFO landing pad, which was actually built in 1967 to celebrate Canada's centennial. It's a 130-ton concrete structure and consists of a raised platform with a map of Canada embossed on the backstop, consisting of stones provided by each province of Canada. The pad also contains a time capsule, which they're scheduled to open on the 100th year anniversary of the pad's opening, which will be in 2067. And a sign beside the pad reads this: "The area under the world's first UFO landing pad was designated international by the town of St. Paul, as a symbol of our faith that mankind will maintain the outer universe free from national wars and strife, that future travel in space will be safe for all intergalactic beings, all visitors from Earth or otherwise are welcome to this territory and to the town of St. Paul." You know, of course, the landing was symbolic for the town and for all of us, I suppose, and in my opinion, kind of mockery. But in that sense, it's a very nice mockery, don't you think?
Yeah, you know, there was some type of politician at some point that lost a race because he was trying to put some, you know, UFO landing pad up somewhere. Did you ever hear about that?
I didn't hear about that,
somewhere in the South, yeah. I was prob- trying. trying to find it before the show, but, you know, I looked around and tried to find the news story. I saw it. It was on some UFO documentary or something. The reason it was brought up in the documentary is that he was just plain ridiculed about it and lost the race and everything. He was actually going to fund it to put it in his own backyard. But before I forget, I wanted to tell the listening audience that we have Judy Meseline from Colorado coming up, and I think it's just 2 weeks, and she'll be on the show. Now, she has the UFO Watchtower in Colorado that's sort of like a landing pad where people come from all over. It was a very active hotspot, and she actually built a tower. And, you know, the old saying, build it and they will come. Well, there's actually been some there's been some sightings there, and people have filmed right there, right from the tower. So she'll be on. That'll be interesting.
That'll be very cool. You know, it's funny. I'm looking at the picture posted here on podcastufo.com, and I encourage our listeners to go there and read the full link to this story as well. But it reminds me, with all the flags and the kind of podium, we're talking about the Winter Olympics happening right now. It almost looks like one of these, you know, things that have to do with the Olympics and the celebration. I don't know if I were a UFO, if I would think I should land here or I should wait for the next luge run, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, or it kind of looks like the UN building, too.
Yeah, it does. Like a little podium outside of some government building, definitely.
Right. Hey, so that's basically it for right now for the news this week. You'll be back next week. But I want you to hang in, if you can, tonight with our talk with Ben Hansen. But can you quickly give your background just so the listener can understand who you are? You have a show. And go ahead and announce, you know, when your show, it actually runs 24 hours from now, right?
It does. 24 hours from now, we will be doing a show called Keeping the Spirits Alive, myself and my co-host, Chip Eichenthal, every Thursday right here on the Dark Matter Radio Network. So you can catch us at 8 p.m. Eastern and doing that weekly. I have another show I do bi-weekly on the A1B Radio Network called The John Tobin Show, ironically enough. But I do a lot of things. I want to keep going with all that. But if you want to find any information on me and who I am and what I do, you can go to gloryhaunthounds.com, kind of one-stop shopping for everything John Tobin. Now, who wouldn't want to do that, right?
That's right. Well, I really enjoyed being on your show. And Chip, what a nice guy he is.
Oh, he's fantastic. He's like my brother, and he's a great guy. And you know, I'm honored to be here. I'm looking forward to doing this every week. I'm learning, as I mentioned to you. And these news stories are a lot of fun. I'm sure we'll hope our listeners will enjoy.
Well, you're not someone that's, you know, typically in the UFO field, but what I liked about our conversation last week, and actually Peggy liked too, and Peggy's important, she's a good contributor to the show, that you have a curiosity, and because of that, you know, I think things will be a little on the fresh side.
Yeah, I do have a very much a curiosity, and not only that, I think there's two things that are important, in my opinion, of the UFO field: having a curiosity and a sense of humor. I think both are important. So, just like I tell people in the ghost stuff, you can't take it all too seriously, or you'll drive yourself nuts. You got to have a little bit of fun with it. So, you know, it's a very much a learning experience, and I've always enjoyed listening to your show, Martin. So I'm honored to be a part of it.
Well, thank you. You know, another thing is, you know, if anyone out there really thinks they have an answer to either, you know, what you do, ghosts, say you're into that part of it, you know, these are things that people are definitely witnessing something, and there's definitely some type of answer for them. But when it comes to UFOs and ghosts and a lot of other paranormal things, if someone says they have an answer, you probably don't want to listen to them.
That's right. Actually, I think I mentioned this to you before, but kind of the less answers, the better in a lot of cases, you know. I think it's a lot better for us to be able to formulate our opinions based on the facts and some of the information we read, and then, you know, research, you know, and you can develop your opinions based off of that. There's so many unanswered questions in both fields that fact becomes a kind of a cliche word. You know, what is fact and what is not fact? What is fact and what is fiction? Which leads to your guest tonight, Ben Hansen, facted or faked or fact or fiction. It kind of goes hand in hand, you know. Fact is a very overused word in both fields, I believe.
Yeah, I think so. And a lot of people, you know, I was listening to, let me just think of what it was. It was, I'm not going to name any names, okay? But I was listening to a person talk about basically, you know, dreams and, you know, life after death type of thing. And the entire, her entire talk was all claims. There was no speculation in it. It was all claims. Like, you know, animals go, you know, to, well, animals go to heaven or whatever. Animals, you'll see your pets when you after you die, and it's like, oh, really? So what happens to the – I'm not going to get too deep here, but what happens to the billion chickens a year that are slaughtered? Do they hang out somewhere too? It's and they're, if they do, they're not going to be too happy to see you, you know?
Yeah, I've never been a fan of people who present their opinion as fact, because you know if it is indeed fact and you're going to present it that way, then just simply prove it to me and we can agree. Otherwise, present it as an opinion and we have no disagreements and I can accept that, you know. But don't present your opinions as absolute fact without cause or probability of any differences in that opinion.
That's right. You know, I keep looking on our Skype to see if Ben Hansen. Ben, if you happen to be listening out there, I hope you sign into your Skype right away so we can call you. Because right now he's offline. So.
Well, what we can do, Martin, I've talked to Ben before, too. You know, you mentioned being a fan of his show, Fact or Fake Paranormal Files, which is a great show. I remember talking to Ben one time, and I see if you've seen this episode, it's UFO-related, that always pops into my head. Did you see the one where they actually went right up to Area 51, kind of camped out outside of there, just a few miles away from the closest viewing point? Had some really weird occurrences. It would be great to ask him about that.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a number of sightings that were on YouTube that looked really, really good that they explored, that they actually found another answer for. And, you know, in one way, I was almost disappointed.
Yeah, I think so. I understand that. I mean, it looks so good. It's like you really wanted it to be, you know, the next thing. But, they didn't present it as evidence. They presented it as here's what we found, and then they did follow up with a lot of it. But there were some things that happened that they couldn't really, you know, put an answer next to. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, there are a number of things. And I wanted to say, you know, we have Andy Fleming. He's from the UK. He is our amateur astronomer and always comes up with a bit. Well, we pre-record shows with him because it's 1 o'clock in the morning there right now. And he did a two-part series on asteroids, and very interesting. First part is 10 minutes, so I'm not going to be able to run it during this show unless Ben – oh, Ben just signed on. So I am going to – for the listener out there, if you want to listen to Ben – if you want to listen to Andy Fleming's bit on near-Earth asteroids and asteroid collisions, just go to our podcast, and it'll be on that tomorrow morning. You can listen to it right there. And so that is going to be it for now, and hang in there, everyone. We'll be right back, and we'll be right back with Ben Hansen. And we do see that there's a number of people in the chat room, and we encourage more to come in and ask Ben some questions. So we'll be right back right after this music break. Ben Hansen, how are you?
Good, good. How are you doing?
Good. Glad to. We panicked just a minute ago. We didn't see you on Skype, but I'm so glad you made it.
I travel invisibly on Skype. I don't get on there until I'm being interviewed.
Hey, you're on the line also with John Tobin. I guess you know John.
Hey, Ben.
I do.
How are you?
Good. Hey, are you getting an echo?
It sounds good here. I'll just wait. Hopefully, Keith Rowland, our producer, is listening. I don't hear one here. How about you, John?
No, I'm not hearing an echo at all. No.
I guess it could be just your Skype only, and it sounds like it's going to be a real pain to put up with, but. You might have to do just that. Sometimes that happens.
Let me see what I think I figured it out. Stand by. Got it.
Okay, good.
Brilliant. What I did, I was listening to you live on the internet as well, and so I was getting two voices.
Oh, boy, yeah. Yeah. Okay, great. Well, hey, so first of all, it's a real pleasure to have you back on, and I don't know if you heard the intro, but, you know, I think you're definitely a voice of reason in the field. And I love the show Factor Faked. I don't know how many dozen episodes I've watched, but you know, you really approach things, you know, in a great scientific way. And you know, the thing about the show, if anyone hasn't watched it, is you actually, you know, try to replicate what people are seeing. And that show's still going along, right?
Well, you know, as of yesterday, even, I think they had an 8-hour marathon. Unfortunately, I think Sci-Fi has just made a lot of changes with their formatting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're pitching new shows, and the word out there on the street is you're not going to really see many of these team-based shows anymore, at least for a while. So it's possible they won't pick it up, but... you know, we adapt like everyone else is, and I'm actually filming some new shows of a different series at the moment. So I think everyone will like it.
Uh-huh. Ben, we have a message board, and sometimes people ask nice questions. Sometimes they ask rather hard questions. And so I'm going to start right off the bat with a hard question.
Okay.
I don't believe that Ben was an FBI agent. We need to ask him to prove it. And also JLL, however you say your name, the pretty girl there, how do you say
JL?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Was never an investigator, and they want you to explain that.
Well, I get I've never heard the one about JL. You can actually see her work on Current TV before. I don't know what's called anymore when they sold over to Al Jazeera, but she did a lot of journalistic work and shows on Current TV, and I'm sure they're floating out there somewhere. Mm-hmm. With mine, you know, I had so many questions about that I got angry sometimes, and I'm just like, I'm just going to take some of my old pay stubs and put them up and, you know, let people know. And, you know, and I thought it's kind of ridiculous, but anyone who wants to really know, they can call up the FBI. In fact, a journalist with the LA Times did it on one story. He was kind of ripping us on one episode that we did, and they told him, they confirmed it. They can confirm that, you know, that I work there. So yeah. There's a number to call, but, yeah, whatever. I don't know where it comes from either. I don't know if people are just, they think I'm too young. I'm actually 36, mm-hmm. You know, so I have a younger face. But I think some people are just can't understand, well, something must have happened. Why is he here working in TV and everything? And the reasons that I'm not are personal to me. It's not quite like you expected to see in the TV shows.
Right. Well, you know, I have a friend that was with the FBI, and, you know, it was there was a lot of what he did was rather on the boring side. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that all FBI agents have boring jobs, but his was, you know, white collar and, you know, just not really that interesting.
Yeah, there's that. I mean, there's preferred squads, you know, that people generally want, and those that, you know, seem to be more office work. And it's also, I mean, government in general can be very bureaucratic. You know, there's some egos involved at times and things like that, but I've always encouraged people
the process to go through if you want to go work for them. In fact, I left the door open to go back because I really do enjoy, you know, public service. There's something just great about, you know, putting people behind bars that shouldn't be out and, you know, preying on others. So I like to have my feet in both both arenas.
Yeah, yeah. Now, that's actually done you a lot of good in the show, Fact or Faked, because you know what to look for. You and I have had conversations through email since you were last on as far as you can tell if someone's right or left-handed. You know, a lot of times you can tell if they're saying the truth when they're talking just by gestures and these little subtle things that they do.
Yeah, and that's been kind of one of my things to try and help bring to the field. You know, like whether it's ghost hunting or UFOs, it's most of the time if somebody, these groups, MUFON, whoever, goes out to investigate, most of the time you're not going to get people who are hoaxing to the extent that they want you to come over and they're going to give you a completely fabricated story. It's the hoaxers who are pulling off huge, complex, you know, long-term events that these skills really come in handy. And even when someone's unsure of what they're saying, there are gestures, you know, that can kind of give you an idea of what's going through their heads. So I found that very useful.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, before we talk about, I'm going to ask you about the UFO Congress that you were at last week. John, do you have a question, any question you want to ask Ben before we get into that?
Yeah, sure. I just want to mention, Ben, for the listeners, too, anybody up in the upstate New York area, we'll be meeting in person for the first time May 2nd through 4th at the ParaHistoryCon 2, shameless plug. Ben's going to be appearing at that, and I'm putting that on. So I just wanted to mention that to you, to the listeners out there. So if you want to meet Ben, that's a great way to do that. But the question I had for you, you are deeply, since the show has been on the long hiatus, I know you've been deeply involved in the production side of television. And I just wanted to know if there are any shows that are currently in production or are getting close to air or doing those sizzle reels and those kind of great things that they do with shows. Is there anything coming up soon from your production company that we should be on the look for?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, the UFO subject is especially hot right now. You're going to see a lot of shows, specials, things like that. And for, I think it's turned in a good way away from this whole, I won't mention any shows, but I think we all know some of them that went a bit too far with the whole, hey, what was that? What happened here? And kind of like, you know, the Scooby-Doo gang investigating. And we're going to see more shows that are sort of ancient aliens, talking heads, but compelling cases, which is my favorite anyways. And my production company is pitching a few, but the ones I'm involved in through other companies, we've got one that has, and I'll talk more about this later. I've been told it's okay to mention, but they haven't officially announced it. So I'm kind of hesitant a little bit on the details, but it's huge because we have the Smithsonian Channel attached to it in the U.S., and we have History Canada. Hmm. And we'll be looking at UFO files. Mainly the government files that are attached to historic cases, and we've already uncovered some amazing discoveries and things that we thought we already, you know, took for granted. And then we've got a couple other kind of two-hour specials and things like that that you'll see possibly on Nat Geo, possibly on History Channel.
Wow. Hey, Ben, a question just came in on the message board. Someone wants to know if you have seen the Greenland video of the mermaid / alien captured by those scientists. Are you familiar with that?
You know, I'm not familiar by the reference. If they're talking about one of the videos that appeared on the documentary, the mermaids, it was on Animal Planet, I think Discovery. If that's the video they're talking about, everything, despite what people believed, everything in that documentary, it's a mockumentary, very well done, but not even the experts were real. The theories, everything about it. So
that yeah. Gets a lot of mileage in the wrong way, if you ask me. But so let's talk quickly, last week you were at the International UFO Congress. Alejandro, friend of the show, and all kinds of great speakers. You had your own table out there, yes?
I did. I wasn't speaking this year. Spoke the last 2 years in a row, and they kind of... I think they have a kind of an unwritten rule that they don't want to have people back more than once in a year. I was there representing my night vision company, Night Vision Ops, and leading their Skywatch, which we did on Friday night.
I see. Uh-huh.
I guess to give you a rundown, of what it was. It was great. The conference, I caught a few of the talks. I enjoyed, seeing Don Schmidt out there speaking about his new book on Wright-Patterson. Mm-hmm. He included a couple of pages on my grandfather and his work there.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was a surprise. Very nice. We also had, David, his last name, speaking about the Black Triangle phenomenon.
Oh, yes. It begins with an M. I know who you mean.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we had George Norrie, of course, appearing and kind of doing some emceeing towards the end. A lot of very strange questions being asked by some people who should probably be on meds. So
I think someone sent a clip of Stephen Bassett getting an award, and they said, you got to watch this because... of something like that. Maybe it was questions asked or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't remember any strange questions asked of him, but yeah, he won the UFO Researcher of the Year award. And I'm trying to remember who won the Lifetime Award. Escapes my mind right now. But I went to a little bit of the banquet, and then the Skywatch was really cool. I'm going to be posting a video. And, I'm guessing this is probably going to turn out to be a geostationary satellite. But for those who haven't seen this before, and myself included, we had a light that was pulsating intervals of about 50 seconds to a minute 20, kind of irregular, and at one point seemed to be responding to a laser flash. But it's in the same location, height of a satellite, but I'm talking really bright, brighter. It could have been like an iridium flare type of a thing, but this thing, was not moving. It was geostationary. So very interesting, because we had an ex-NORAD official with us.
Really?
And he said, he's become a friend. And he said, typically when he was watching the scopes on these things, there are very few geostationary, meaning, the ones that follow the speed of the Earth, very few of them rotate. They try to stabilize them on their three axes, so you're not catching that panel, catching the light and pulsating. So we'll post it. I'm not claiming it's anything, but it's something to look for, and you can really see them, picked up in the night vision.
Wow. I was on John Tobin's show actually last week, and that's what gave me this brilliant idea to have him on for as our new news guy. And one of the things I, came up with or mentioned or whatever, but it's not, my direct words, it's just things that I think of. We can only observe so much. We only have so much of a spectrum we can see in. We only have so much we can observe from all the senses that we have in the range that they're in. So when it comes to things like night vision, that adds kind of another perception to see things. And I'm wondering, I know you sell that night, the really high quality, high end night vision. Do you think that there's a lot more seen with night vision than just the naked eye?
I do. And it's not so much, there is some experimentation into looking into the non visible light spectrum, so high UV or low IR, but it's not so much that as the fact that you're just looking at amplified light about 50 to 80,000 times. So you go out and you see a handful of stars one night. Well, when you use these, you're seeing, you know, probably 20 times more and 20 times more aircraft, satellites, whatever's up there. So, yeah, I think it does greatly enhance. A lot of the objects I've seen, I would not be able to see them with the unaided eye.
Now, the FBI just, I heard this on the news the other day, that they just, there's some type of, something has just gone through to stop, or they're going to try to stop lasers, because you mentioned pointing a laser up, and I know that there's a lot of laser attacks in cockpits of commercial flights. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know that there's an outbreak per se. We, when I worked the duty desk, I got a few calls about lasers at the FBI, and it is a federal offense. You have to be really careful, and it's really unfortunate that there are people out there who might ruin it for the rest of us. I know in Australia there are certain of the states that restrict them altogether, and, you know, or use outside and things like that. We don't want that to happen because the studies, you know, do show, I mean, if you're accurate with pointing it, the glass just refracts and it bounces around in the cockpit, and we don't want to be doing that. So we hope that doesn't happen. When I go out on Skywatches, I tell people, look, if it looks like a plane, sounds like a plane, don't point it anywhere near it.
That's right. That's right. So, hey, we got another question on the message board here, and it says, Ben, do you believe life exists on other planets? Do you think aliens are among us or here on Earth? That's someone who's curious.
Okay. I would have to answer in probabilities. I do believe, I guess I could say, well, just as much as I believe anything else, that there is life on other worlds. I don't see how there couldn't be. Mm-hmm. I personally have not come in contact. I say jokingly, but I'm not to make little of those who say they have, but no, I haven't had any encounters myself in that way. But I have heard from very credible people who I believe. And it would seem that if you add their stories along with physical evidence, along with the probability, especially my own experiences of craft that I've seen, I would say there's probably a good 95% chance, you know, that we've been visited. Mm-hmm. And are they here among us? Well, I really have no way to answer that. I suppose they could be, you know, because if they indeed, a lot of encounters, you know, you talk about human, for all intents and purposes, humans that we're encountering, then why not? I mean, if they wanted to, you know, park the ship and walk around, I guess they could.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the last time you were on, I actually have part of the intro of you basically stating what your grandfather had told you or told your father. And I got to tell you, I had so many emails from that one quote, basically. And just for someone who hasn't heard that story last time, would you mind just doing a short recap about your grandfather and what he said to your father?
Sure. My grandfather, and this is actually detailed a lot in Don Schmidt's new book about it, Wright-Patterson. I think it's called the Real Area 51. Nothing to do with Area 51, but at any rate, my grandfather served in the Marines and then the Army. When he retired, he began in, I think it was 1952 or 50, till about 1980, working as a civilian engineer for the Air Force. His assignment basically was the logistics of workspaces. And it was very strange because in about 1964, he came to my father, who was 15 at the time, and said, I've been asked to be part of a special team that could be called at a moment's notice. And when I leave, you're in charge of the family, and I can't be here. And he said, well, where do you go? What's it for? And he said, well, it's like for emergencies. And he said, like a nuclear threat. And he said, we asked something like that. Well, so the first time my father remembers was 1965 when he got a call and my grandpa had to hurry and get ready. In the morning, he flew out and was gone for about 2 weeks. So there's a lot of details to this, but basically when he was out there at Wright-Patterson, he wasn't available by phone. My grandmother was very sick and almost died, and my dad was frantically trying to get a hold of him. It caused a rift between them for a while because, you know, my father was very stressed and said, why can't you answer the phone? Why can't you be available? Grandpa told him, well, not everywhere I was had phones. He said, what do you mean not everywhere there were phones? There's phones everywhere. He said, not everywhere I was working was above ground. It was then that we learned one of his duties was kind of to maintain and help design underground hangar systems, which we know there's a large network of underground facilities at that base.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my dad kept pumping him as he, you know, got older. He kept asking him as we're watching, you know, Unsolved Mysteries or these types of shows. And hey, is any of this true? Are we being visited? Is what they say about back engineering Roswell craft? Is there any, you know, validity to that? You were there. What? Tell me. Well, he would change the subject. He'd just walk away. Or why do you want to know that? You know. It wasn't until he died of cancer in 1998, and they were there in the hospital room, and my father was, I barely missed him about an hour before he passed, but my dad said he took him by the hand, and my grandpa looked at him, looked him in the eyes, and he said, son, I want you to know that we're not alone, and I don't want you to be afraid. And he was saying it not in the context he's certain it wasn't like because there's life after death or whatever. He knew he was answering his question finally about the, you know, extraterrestrials. And he shortly passed away. So we have been gathering as much as we can of his work because he did, and I you know, respect my grandfather for keeping his oath. He didn't ever really tell us anything, but we're learning more and more about the times he was gone. And it's kind of fun to speculate because you line up the dates where he left.
Mm.
At least on some occasions, they line up with incidents like Kecksburg crash, you know, and when that was supposed to go to Wright-Patterson or Malmstrom Air Force Base. And so some very interesting coincidences.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, I agree with what you said. You know, I personally had a sighting, but I agree, you know, when you said 95% that we're being visited, that's kind of where I'm at too, you know, because I can't say 100% because I'm not positively sure, but I can say, you know, 95% with all these, you know, witnesses and including myself. But the thing that always gets me, and I just wonder what your take is on that, is why it's not taken more seriously, you know, by mainstreams, let's say media or scientists. There's no funding for it. We try to find out what dark matter is, dark energy. We spend all kinds of money on that, and we have no clue if it really exists. But when it comes to something that people are seeing in the skies constantly, why do you think there's no serious work done on that?
You know, that's a good question because my degree was sociology and criminology, and I'm always looking at the psychosocial aspect of any question. And my research, I've done a lot into kind of trying to theorize how people, I guess, use videos and photographs and things like that to try and get somebody to believe or change a belief or something. And what I've been able to equate it to is kind of like when we watch the news and we hear about war. when something big, traumatic, impactful is going on, we might be interested for a few days, maybe a few weeks, maybe a big disaster happens and our heart goes out to them. But as we continue to see images, and it's kind of the same thing, we become desensitized to the point where this flood of information has reached a threshold that is no longer impacting us in the same way. And I feel like we're so used to hearing about UFOs and reports and things like that now. Then we've had so many hoaxes, or Chinese lanterns and things that turned out to be nothing, mm-hmm. that it's pretty much saturated to the point where seeing or talking about a sighting is no longer impactful. It would literally take that war to come to your doorstep or to have someone in your family get killed before it really impacts your life. And I think the same way with UFOs. When sightings are starting to shut down airports like they did in China a few times, mm-hmm. That impacts your life. Until they actually come down maybe and have an open media event or something, we all have to go to work the next day. We think it's fun. We watch it on the TV shows. We talk about it. Pop culture is huge. But it's in that fun category because we have other things to concern ourselves with, like what's Kim Kardashian wearing right now? Or, we distract ourselves. And I think that's one reason. And the other is that I think it's treated kind of like a religion in that it's really intangible and beliefs about things that we can't just put our hands around and show somebody that it exists. Despite all of the evidence for it, I think science views it that way, that it's very, intangible and not worth the time to study. So there's not the urgency at this point.
Hey, Ben, I had a question for you real quick. John here. I want to just, you mentioned earlier about you and Martin were talking about the likeliness of having visitation from extraterrestrials or places, people or beings from other places, for lack of a better term. I asked Martin this the other day as well, and this is something that I think about quite often. If they have these visitations, and it's possible that this has happened quite often in circumstances, what is the likeliness or what is your opinion on whether or not they are roaming around our planet freely, that they are perhaps look like you and I, and we don't know that they're even here? Is that a possibility?
I guess it's always a possibility. It's a little bit more crazier of a notion, but I guess if you already accept, there's a good 95% chance I've been here, then why not? It's just it's a place I haven't really gone yet because it's too easy for people to post these things online and say so and so is an extraterrestrial and look at their reptilian eyes and the Anunnaki is here and. This or this person in government is really an alien in disguise. And I'm like, oh, come on. So it's too easy to say that. And that's why I think it's not really taken seriously. And there's not really any way you could prove it. But I guess it's a possibility.
Just to mention that, I agree. There's probably no way to prove it. But it goes hand in hand with the visitations. Besides the witnesses that are seeing them, it's really a difficult thing to prove. So, and I know it's far-fetched, but I think it kind of goes hand in hand. I think the likeliness that I think I agree with you, with both you and Martin, that it's probably likely that we have been visited. But in the same circumstances, if these beings are able to visit us and land on our planet and live in our atmosphere, why would they not be able to walk among us? Maybe because of their appearance, but would they be able to disguise that appearance? I just think it's a fascinating thing to think about, and you're right. It's hard to take seriously for the general public, but I think it's certainly a possibility.
Ben, I'm sorry, we have a number of questions pouring in.
Okay.
First of all, I want to apologize to the live listener out there because according to our message board, they had about 10 minutes or something where they lost sound. I really apologize for that. And if you want to catch this as a podcast tomorrow, it'll be on podcastufo.com. A couple of questions. One of them, Ben, do you think reversed engineering came from technology found in Area 51? Well, probably. I'll rephrase the question a little different, but I understand what they're getting at. Do you think there has been some reverse engineering? Do you think that's a possibility?
I think there's a very strong possibility of that. You know, one of the strongest arguments, of course, that people make is look at the leaps in technology that we made, you know, after the 40s crashes. And I also know of people who told their sons in their dying last few months, you know, these are World War II heroes, and telling them, having handled the debris from Roswell and it being studied at Wright-Patterson and the unusual properties and even some of the entities, that if we had that and it was farmed out, you know, to private contractors, yeah, I think that is a big possibility. And the fact that even just in the 50s, we had flying saucers of our own, that they weren't, the propulsion isn't, you know, what we'd expect. You know, but like hovercraft type things where they're already trying to imitate, you know, the flying saucers. So, yeah, I think it's very much part of our program.
Yeah, and there was a lot of speculation of the Nazis and all that, you know. Another question came in on the message board, and what is your opinion of the work of Tesla and what Otis Carr continued on with? Do you feel that Carr's work was responsible for early sightings and development of technologies?
Yeah, Tesla, I think his time, you know, came too soon. It seems like he was definitely on to something there with the government, you know, contracts and what he said he could do. And I think those who have researched it and tried to continue are on the right track. But he's by no means the... I think the only person who stumbled upon it, but the electromagnetism, and you know, I'm not too well versed into physics, but from what I understand, with displacing inertia and the way that you know, gravity, waves, and all this stuff is supposed to work, if anyone knew about it, probably was Tesla.
One other question someone wants to ask you is, what do you feel about disclosure? And I think we almost sort of covered that before when we talked about, you know, why don't they take it serious? You know, I mean, it would have to take a major leak or sighting or something seen by, you know, millions of people. And, you know, I think that's kind of where we were going with that. Is that so?
That it would take something like that,
yeah.
You mean? Well, you know, if you, and I know you do, you attend these conferences, there's two extremes, and they have panels, in fact, with Steve Bassett and John Alexander, and then you've got Richard Dolan, you know, they wrote the one of the books on it, too, and they all have their differing opinions on how they think it's going to happen, and of course, Stephen Bassett would love the government to announce it. John Alexander thinks the government doesn't really know much and there's no cover-up. But personally, I don't think that a display is really going to do it either. In my lectures, I talk about what would happen if tomorrow morning you had an alien craft land on the White House lawn and the creature gets out. He gives a press conference. He allows us all day long to film in and outside his craft. We take that film and we put it on the 10 o'clock news. How many people do you think still will not believe that it happened?
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's,
even if the president announced it himself, it'd still be a lot of people that would doubt it.
You would think it's a new ploy, you know, trying to pass a measure through, or if it was on TV, it's like a trailer for a new film. You know, I think we would probably be no better off, and the greatest discovery in this century would just be like, yeah, some alien was on TV last night. That's pretty cool. You know, I just don't think it would have the impact until it's like personally in your face and things are starting to change in our world.
I think so. And I agree also with what you said earlier. I think it's a very ephemeral society. In other words, if something happens, they get over it very quickly. Okay, what's next? And, you know, go about their business. So I'm not really sure. You know, there's been a lot of discussion in the past that things would just simply fall apart if there was a visitation, you know, a confirmed visitation, and we're not alone and all that. But I tend to think that it would just be absorbed and people would move on with their lives.
I think they're ready for it, and I don't think that, quite honestly, if we are being visited, that those who have been here, they don't mean to destroy us, or they wouldn't have waited this long. You know, so I think that we could. There's always going to be those who panic, and there's going to be some chaos, but sure, why not? As long as you keep people working and they have jobs and stuff to do or, you know, reality shows to watch, they'll be fine.
That's right. That's right. So let me just look at our one more time here because we're getting close to the end here on our message board. It's funny. There's so many messages coming in. I just lost what I was going to just ask you. Here it is right here. You just answered this question. Do you believe that aliens would harm us? So you just kind of answered that. Thank you. So I want you to talk quickly about your – we have just 3 minutes left. So if you would talk quickly about, you know, your night vision stuff, because I think that,
okay,
that is interesting.
Sure. My website's being worked on at the moment, so I can't – I don't think I can accept direct purchases yet, but just contact me on there and we'll get you set up. But it's nightvisionops.com. And my thing is that I'm trying to get in people's hands something more affordable than what's, you know, traditionally been out there, and something that you can film with. Because I've seen a few things myself, and it's just kicking me, you know, kicking myself for not having something to record. So we have scopes, binoculars, things that record directly to your iPhone if you want. Things you can connect up to your DSLR camera.
Wow, to your iPhone?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, that's great because everybody has an iPhone. Now, is this something that's not very bulky?
Not at all. In fact, the binocular is only about, I'd say, like 5 inches long or so.
Mm-hmm.
And you put the iPhone on that, slip it in the end of it. You've got generation, you know, 3 night vision to record to. And, you know, any type of setup you want, we could probably make it. And we sold so many at the UFO Congress that we're going to be doing some specials, you know, through Open Minds and trying to get more of these out there.
Wow. Wow. Well, that's great. Well, Ben, where can someone reach you? I mean, I found you initially, I believe, through your website. Yes?
Probably. Yeah. There's, I believe there's a contact. There's, you know, Facebook, Twitter, and all that contact through benhansen.com. It's H-A-N-S-E-N. So you can go on there. That's probably the easiest way. I also answer at the nightvisionops.com for questions about the night vision.
Now, are you going to be attending any other shows coming up?
Yeah, a lot. You know, I'm between ghost events and UFO events. So all the events are up there. In fact, I'm going up to do a UFO type lecture at the USS Hornet up in San Francisco this weekend.
Oh, really? Yeah. My old stomping grounds.
Yeah, beautiful city. Love it up there.
Oh, yes. But you want to get there this time of year, too. Yeah. Well, hey, one quick question. I just see that I'm actually out of time. I only have 10 seconds left, so I'll save that for next time. It was a real pleasure.
All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben.
All right. So that's it for our show today. And if you missed any part of the show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which is podcastufo.com. Also, you can check out links and stories in our show notes, as well as joining in the conversation on our forums. I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Of course, Keith Rowland, producer of Dark Matter Radio. Ben, for being on. Thank you, Ben. John Tobin, thanks for joining the show. And later, just remember to listen to Andy Fleming's take on asteroids. I want to thank Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for our music. Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. And remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. You can check us out live here, right here at the Dark Matter Radio Network every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And don't forget to jump in the chat room at Podcast UFO. So now here's part one of part two of Asteroids with Andy Fleming.
Well, in the 1970s, Professor Walter Alvarez, who was Earth and Planetary Science professor at the University College at Berkeley, he developed a hypothesis. And that included asteroid impacts, global iridium layers in rock strata, and, of course, the extinction of the dinosaurs. Have you heard of the Cretaceous-Tertiary or KT mass extinction event, Martin?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Okay, well, that theory has been verified by geological dating, and basically what Alvarez discovered was a huge crater at Chicxulub on the Yucatan Peninsula. Now, the theory was totally shocking because basically it stated that 66 million years ago, the Earth was hit by a gigantic space rock 10 kilometres in diameter, and it was travelling at, wait for it, 40,000 kilometres per hour. Hmm. Bit faster than your car, Martin. Yeah. Basically, it took 2 seconds to come through the atmosphere and, of course, buried itself deep into the Earth. I think it's sort of fairly well known that the resultant ejective from it caused worldwide cataclysmic fires, dense choking dust and smoke, and, of course, it blocked out the sunlight for years.
Now, I had heard I had heard that there was every single place on Earth was on fire when instantly. Is that,
that's correct.
Yeah, amazing. Because they can tell by the sedimentary layer of that.
Iridium and carbon.
Uh-huh.
That's right, in the rock record. Now, of course, with all that going on, as you can imagine, temperatures plummeted and 75% of all species, including the dinosaurs, became extinct. Now, the survivors of all of this destruction were small dinosaurs capable of flight, which are now modern-day birds, and also to survive were tiny underground, sort of like shrew-like creatures that lived on roots.
Why do you suppose the birds in flight, how could they have survived?
Well, I presume they'd be small. They were probably nesting and roosting in caves or somewhere that wasn't sort of going to be affected by what was going on in the outside open atmosphere.
But to eat food, I mean, there couldn't have been any food left after a while.
Well, yeah, presumably there may have been the odd seed, you see, because obviously some of the dinosaurs, the feathered type, were at that stage starting to eat seeds. There'd have been dead plant material available. And these tiny little shrew-like animals that were living underground, like moles or whatever, they'd be feeding on roots, the equivalent of turnip roots or potatoes or whatever, that sort of thing. Now, the dinosaurs lived on Earth for about 150 million years, and really they break the record for longevity. I mean, they were the most successful species of animal ever to have lived, really. I mean, we've been here, what, Homo sapiens? What would you say, Martin?
Very, very short time.
Yeah. Hundreds of thousands of years max. Now, the extinction ushered in the age of the mammals. And, of course, those mammals evolved into us, you and me, and listeners. So you could say, really, without Chicxulub, we simply wouldn't exist, and the mammals truly did inherit the Earth. Now, all of this sounds like fantastic news, doesn't it?
Mm.
But it isn't. Because more research shows that what happened to the dinosaurs happened repeatedly over 4.5 billion years of the Earth's history, and it's going to happen again.
Hmm.
And do you know how you can prove it to yourself? What we were talking about last week, lunar craters.
Yeah.
Look at the moon through binoculars and you'll see, because there's no weathering or geological erosion, that pristine surface. It's a horrifying record of continuing routine planetary violence. And if you look at things like the Tycho and Copernicus craters, they dwarf the Yucatan impact site that killed off the dinosaurs.
Hmm.
Now, we're very lucky now because we're at an age in our development, Homo sapiens, that we've got NASA, right? Much maligned NASA, but it's one of the best agencies in the world. We've got the Planetary Society and we've got the B612 Foundation. They're all asking not if, but when this is going to happen again. So the B612 Foundation's aim, really, is to alter the orbit of potentially hazardous asteroids, otherwise known as PHAs. The problem is, of course, that NASA aren't absolutely certain that they have discovered all the big asteroids, and it's not the ones that they know about that they worry about, it's the ones that they don't know about that can come out of the blue. Now, at the end of the day, B612 has a project called Sentinel, and it's organising it. It's in its early stages. And the first step is to launch an infrared telescope, space telescope. Why? Because infrared is a form of light that asteroids emit in copious quantities. It's going to take off on a SpaceX Falcon 9 booster. And the telescope, when it's in orbit around the sun, will reside in an orbit at a similar distance, really, to Venus. It's going to catalogue about 90% of asteroids with diameters larger than 140 metres. And it's going to be launched by 2020. It's a private project. It's led by NASA's Rusty Schweikart, who you'll remember from Apollo 9, and Ed Lu, along with Clark Chapman. They're in the process of raising $450 million for the mission.
Which is really a pittance when you think about it.
Well, what's our future worth, Martin?
Yeah.
Something very worrying happened last year, and that was that in early 2013, we talked about this again last week, a 20-metre, just 20-metre diameter asteroid entered the Earth's atmosphere. I mean, this is a pinprick compared to what killed the dinosaurs.
Right.
And, of course, from the videos, we saw that it became brilliant Super Bowl-eyed meteor, didn't it? It exploded in an airburst over Chelyabinsk. That's in Russia, of course. The explosion was 23 kilometres in altitude in the atmosphere. And, of course, that was enough to injure people, wreck windows. Just think what would have happened if that had come to the ground.
Right.
This, of course, heightened all concern and led to a huge surge of interest in projects like Sentinel, run by the B612 Foundation. And, of course, these projects are designed to detect these PHAs before they impact the Earth. The question I've got to ask you and listeners is, are we going to invest as a culture in such planet-saving technology, or are we going to suffer the fate of the dinosaurs? Now, T-Rex had an excuse for its extinction because it lacked intelligence. We don't.
So that's basically it for part one. You'll be back next week with part two. Is that right?
I'm looking forward to it, Martin. I hope you are too.
Yes.
And listeners.
This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky and your curiosity high. See you later.